organization. And I think this is again an area post-COVID that we really need to think about how to re-energize that civic society base that that Chipo was talking about to broaden the space. Because I think in addition to the problems with COVID-19, these authoritarians have used this pandemic to break down civil society and to also break down the opposition. And I think this is a theme we'll keep having in the elections that are upcoming in Uganda pretty soon, and probably in Kenya in the next couple years.
David, we should point out, by the way, that the leader in Guinea-Conakry is Alpha Conde.
Yes, okay. My apologies. Yes.
Alpha Conde, thank you. When you talk about French influence in Francophone Africa, yes. But when you look at history, it really wasn't in Guinea-Conakry, especially because the founding president of Guinea-Conakry, Sékou Touré, was the only individual that said no to a sort of French Commonwealth that had actually been suggested by the French president, General Charles de Gaulle. You remember? To the extent that, in fact, Guinea was the second indigenous African country to regain her political independence after Ghana, which had gotten its independence in 1957. But that does not really change anything much, because when you think about the manner in which those countries hold elections, and a lot of other countries on the continent, there are very few countries that have gotten it. Ghana is one of them. You have countries like Benin, you have Senegal, you have countries like South Africa, you have countries like the Seychelles. They only recently, after 43 years of one party in power, the opposition actually won an election. You have several countries in Southern Africa which have embraced the concept of democracy. You have a lot of other countries in West Africa, certainly not so many in Central Africa, not so many in East Africa, not so many in North Africa. What do you think, in your view, needs to be done, needs to happen, so that African countries sincerely can begin to hold elections that are for the benefit of the primary stakeholder, their people, and not for example, their development partners, the donor community?
Alpha Conde, I was just looking up some things about him, and I think he's 87 years old this year, 87 or 82.
82.
82.
I actually had the dubious privilege of having dinner with him last year here in Washington.
Well, why did he want to run again, did he say?
It's just like other few of his colleagues on the continent, when they actually want to hang on to power, what they tell you is essentially that they are, quote unquote, succumbing to the pressure of their people.
That it is the people that want them, and therefore they stay in power for a long time. You know, I think David raises an important point that COVID has caused some further restrictions, and that we're going to see more authoritarianism because of COVID and leaders using that as an excuse. But to your earlier question about the fact that there is no separation of the state from the military, there's no separation of the state. But I also think it goes back to that the presidents, the executive, they control everything and they control the money.
Right.
And it's so because the ruling party, you only get access to resources when you are in the ruling party. So everybody wants to be in the ruling party. in Zimbabwe recently saw a member of the ruling party try to leave the country with about 6 kgs of gold. Because you're in the ruling party, you have access to natural resources, right? You can just go up and dig. So I think
if I might interject in, do not forget that when you are talking about who controls the state, controls everything almost, in fact, including oxygen, because the state in those situations happens to be the single largest employer and the single largest contractor.
And so when I think about this, I think because, you know, one of the candidates we're talking about is from the diaspora, and I was just looking up my own other work looks at the remittances that are sent to African countries. The three of us here, I'm sure we understand what it means to be sending remittances. In Kenya, the data that I just saw for yesterday say that this year alone, there've been about $6 billion that's been remitted back to Kenya. The numbers are just as high in Francophone African countries. The numbers are high in Zimbabwe and other countries. And so I think there is an opportunity for the diaspora to collectively use the remittances as a bargaining point for democracy. Because I think at the end of the day, finances do matter, right? So how finances are distributed, taxation matters. And if citizens and countries don't feel safe to speak up for themselves, I think that the diaspora is in a unique place to mobilize. And we saw that in the Gambia, right? The ouster of President Jammeh, there was a lot of credit that was given to the work that was done by the diaspora and the mobilization, the support for civil society, the support for voters, right? Creating opportunities for people to securely submit their vote. So there is a whole other constituency that we don't engage enough, which is the diaspora. And the diaspora has a role to play in all of these elections that might mitigate some of the challenges that locals are facing. Now, most countries don't allow diaspora voting, but quite a number of countries have now moved towards allowing diaspora voting. Ghana, Kenya, I'm not sure. I don't think Uganda has diaspora voting, but huge diaspora population. And so the diaspora should be using their voices in effective ways, I think, to push for more democratization back home.
What about the issue of the international community stepping in? You know as well as I do, for example, that Africa used to attract many military coups. That is no longer the case. And the reason is very simple, because coups sort of run out of vogue simply because the international community is no longer willing to do business as usual with a sergeant or a colonel or a general who shoots his way with an AK-47 to power. Why doesn't the international community also adopt a policy that says if you actually hold an election and there is incontrovertible evidence that you have rigged or stolen that election in order to stay in power, the international community is no longer going to do business as usual with you? That if you also, for example, engage in the business of the shifting of political constitutional goalposts for your personal and political interests, the international community is no longer going to continue doing business with you. Don't you really think that would work as a sort of political detente?
Yeah, I'm a little skeptical on that one, Shaka. And I say that because let's not forget a lot of these major powers and former colonial powers have interest in the status quo. So Guinea, Ivory Coast, Tanzania, Kenya, Zimbabwe, Uganda, they were not created for the benefit of the people in those countries. They were really centers of extraction for the British and the French in whichever these regions were. So right to this day, a lot of these former colonial powers and major powers have their interests, which are not always in sync with the narrative of democratization, especially when the candidate who looks like they're about to win an election is not particularly favored by some of these major powers. And we saw it with the Muslim Brotherhood in Egypt, and there's a whole litany of these cases. I would propose, piggybacking on what Chipu had mentioned, to re-engage the civic society, civil society groups in particular, and with a particular emphasis of enabling them to generate resources locally and to entrench their legitimacy locally. Because part of our problem has been civil society is they're too dependent on foreign donations, which really raises questions about their authenticity and their credibility. In other words, who's really the calling the shots here? So even locally, that's something I think we should really be thinking about. And I'd also like to make one more point on what Chipu had mentioned about diasporans. This is something we've been interrogating recently, in relation to Eastern Africa. And I think one of the challenges with the diasporans, why we're not as engaged, is one, we're very divided, because a lot of the divisions that are on the continent get transplanted in North America or Europe, right? Whether it's Shona Ndebele cleavages, whether it's Kikuyu Luo in Kenya, whether it's Fulani, Fulani or Yoruba Hausa, Igbo with the Nigerians, whether it's Burkinabe versus Bole in, Ivory Coast. And to re-engage the diaspora is challenging in that regard, but also in regards to the fact that Chipu, when I send money to my mom or to my auntie, the government, yes, takes a percentage of that, but it's difficult to disengage the remittances for survivalists, for consumption, from the political narrative. It's really a tricky one, because how do you tell a Zimbabwean not to send money back home to their struggling uncle or auntie who needs life-saving medication because they're upset with the Mnangagwa regime because he's getting 15% of that remittance? So I think part of the strategy needs to be reconfigured around, if it's remittances, in terms of how then do we create an economic muscle for these remittances. And I would move more, Shaka, within the angle of how are diaspora groups organizing here, for example, in the context of Ivory Coast, to really hold Alassane Ouattara accountable. What I would be interested in seeing is diaspora communities in North America putting pressure on the IMF very directly to hold them accountable. This was your man in New York. This was your man in Washington. And look at what he's doing in our country. His policies, his governance is not conducive to economic and social justice, the long-term economic and social justice for Ivorians. I think for diasporans, these are some of the narratives we should be interrogating. How do you, example, hold Alassane Ouattara accountable by putting pressure on those donors in the West, whom he knows on first-name basis, to really put his feet to the fire and say, what you're doing in Ivory Coast is not right. Alpha Conde, what you're doing in Guinea Conakry is not appropriate. And to Magufuli, what you're doing with the CCM in Tanzania, your denial of the COVID virus, your repression of your people is unacceptable.
You know, you remind me of a statement, associated with a professor, Henry Kissinger, who once said that politics is religion. And of course, I'm also equally reminded of the classic work of a professor, Hans Morgenthau, who in his book of Politics Among Nations talks about how countries have neither permanent allies nor permanent adversaries. What they have is permanent interests. Mm-hmm. And so when interests basically change, the alliances keep shifting. You said already that the international community would not be that sort of democratic referee precisely because it has its own selfish interests.
Mm-hmm.
I am reminded here again by my friend, Ghanaian and Pan-Africanist, Professor George Aite, who actually said that part of the reason Africa is where it is, not serving its people, is simply because at independence, Africa inherited the same colonial vehicle and only changed the drivers. That in fact what Africa should have done, and probably if it is not too late, should do, is essentially become creative, innovative, and create its own vehicle rather than changing the drivers. How do you respond to that, Chipo?
You know, I think I like Professor Aite. I like his work. I like to follow him. I do think that sometimes he tends to want us to throw the baby out with the bathwater. You know, and he has reasons to think that way. But before I respond to that, just to come back to what you said about international intervention, in Zimbabwe with the last coup, the thing that I would learn later is that the embassies in Harare were all very engaged. I think, you know, this is the first time that Americans were sort of neutral and stood back. But the British, the representative for England, I had a chance to meet with them. And I learned two things from that meeting. The first is that our international partners, they don't respect us. That was number one. Number two, it was
why don't they respect us? Isn't it perhaps because we do not respect ourselves?
No, absolutely not. I think they were in my presence and they kept repeating things to me that the opposition is a joke because the person leading the opposition is young. And so their view of young Africans, at least in the Zimbabwean context, was that we don't have the chops to lead ourselves. And so because of that, the position from the British consulate at the time was that they should align with ZANU-PF. And they were taking a lot of pride in having facilitated the coup. And it really came down to complete disrespect of what Zimbabweans want and a complete disrespect of young Zimbabweans. And in my pushback, I say, you see this young man, Nelson Chamisa, whom you speak of like this, if he was a young British, a young white elite British, you would say that he is innovative. You would say that his ideas are bright and they are smart. But when he talks about building a country that is based on technology in Zimbabwe, you look at him and you say he's ridiculous. Because in your mind, as young Africans, we're not capable of seeing beyond our role as puppets, really, to the West. That our role as Africa be to produce the raw material that builds wealth for the Western world, and that we are not capable of innovation. So, you know, prior to that meeting, I had been really convinced that our relationship with Western countries could be useful. But I think it's not just about respecting ourselves, but it is really about realizing that the world is based on interests that have nothing to do with our development.
I see what you mean. And in fact, you remind me of reading a book about builders of the empire. When you think about those young British who built the British Empire, which presided over territory where the sun never set, When you talk, for example, about Sir John Cecil Rhodes, the man, unfortunately for you, whose territory that was supposed to be Zimbabwe was named after him, Rhodesia. He was an incredibly young man.
He was.
When you look at Dr. David Livingstone, these were incredibly young men. If those people could do it, what about our own young men and women?
Yeah, Shaka, this is a good question, but I would push back on your lionization of Rhodes and Livingstone, because in a large part of the continent, these were the purveyors of the tyranny and roots of exploitation of our continent. You think of Rhodes in Rhodesia, his vision of the Cape to Cairo Imperial Empire. These were the men and women who established pure, naked, mercantilist exploitation of the continent, whose structures, by the way, are still in place today. Kenyan tea is produced raw and packaged and sold at a fortune, and the benefit goes, the branding goes to England, not to Kenya. Cocoa from Ivory Coast, and so on.
Maybe I didn't make myself understood, or you misunderstood what I meant.
Yes.
In a sense, I meant to say that those young British men, whatever they were doing, was in the service of promoting the British Empire, essentially at the expense of those of us who called Africa home.
I think this is an interesting narrative that we really need to unpack and develop on the continent. This emphasis of global norms around human rights, around corporate governance, around good governance on the continent. And I think this is something that is very much needed in Guinea, very much needed in Ivory Coast, and also very much needed in Tanzania. We cannot have a system where major powers only emphasize their interests, because it always comes back to bite them when they ignore situations in Somalia or Afghanistan or some of the so-called failed states, the weaker countries.
I have confidence and hope in the changing demographics on the African continent in tandem with their social media, because their social media empowers them enormously. It brings information to their fingertips. They are the sort of generation that is more exposed than any other generation before it. Chipo and David, I have to say frankly once again that I am profoundly honored and exceedingly humbled to have had the opportunity to have this incredible, incredible conversation. Thanks to our audience for tuning into Straight Talk Africa. In the meantime, get better, not bitter, Africa. And please, please remember to keep the African hopes alive.